On this week's Devils in the Details, we talk about Erik ten Hag after a week of crazy performances and results against Brentford, Chelsea, and Liverpool. We also discuss some internal personnel questions and perhaps mourn the loss of a million points that has happened this week. All right, Case, this has been quite the run of matches and results since we last got the chance to sit at the microphones. How are you doing, and how are you finding this United team? It feels like it just keeps getting worse, to be honest. That Brentford game was the worst performance I've seen this season by a mile, and it's not like some of the others were... It's not even like the bar is high. It was just bad, even by this season's standards, which were already bad.
Yeah, we're going to get into it in greater detail. I think it's really difficult to exaggerate how bad the performances have been this season. And I'll quantify that later for all of you listening. But to say I'm shocked I'm not shocked. It's exactly what I expect every time I turn on the TV. It's exhausting. But
yeah, in a weird way, because I'm shocked that it's gotten this bad overall, but I'm not shocked now week to week. Exactly. The fundamentals aren't there. I'm not tuning in expecting this team to play well. Honestly, if not for this podcast, I'd begin to question whether I would tune in. I probably would, because it's football and I always tune in no matter how often I say this, but it really is just the same thing every week.
Yeah. Different flavors of the same ice cream. Okay. Let's get into some questions. We did one positive this week is we did have some really good questions. So... We're gonna do a few of those.
Yeah. Let's start with a big one that I think we actually got a couple weeks ago, but we haven't had the chance to answer on a podcast. Richard Brown asks, and this is a relatively long one, so bear with me here. I know you've been looking at a post-Ten Hag future, and I've reluctantly come to accept United must do the same. But there are some questions I can't put aside yet, as I try to rationalize how Erik ten Hag has screwed up so badly. For instance, were his failings... a comprehension of modern football tactics, but the inability to apply them effectively, apparent in his Ajax sides or last season's United side? Were we more forgiving last year because some progress and modernizing was taking place while still having to field De Gea, Wan-Bissaka, Martial, etc. more often, limiting that progress? If we were to rewatch a match from last season, even one of the good ones before the League Cup final, Anfield and Martinez's injury, would we see signs of the disaster to come in 2023-24 and the tactics and team performances back then? So there's a lot there.
Yeah, I really like this question. Aaron and I have tried to answer this question like the last three or four times we've recorded and then just not been able to fit it in. And I think it's as relevant now as it was a few weeks ago when we got this sent to us through our email, by the way, which there is an email account that you can send questions to. It's devilsitdpod@gmail.com for anybody who's not on Twitter and wants to be involved in Q&A. You can do that any week. I check that email pretty regularly. But yeah, to answer Richard's question. Last season, there were definitely signs. And I definitely think we were more forgiving than we should have been. I think there's some reason for that. You know, anytime a manager's in their first season, I think you do cut them some slack and assume that they're making some compromises. He also openly said he was making compromises in press conferences. And there were definitely personnel limitations. But you can, and I have gone back and watched some of those matches, and a lot of the things that are sort of haunting the side this season were there. They were just sort of hedged. It was a stratified press. It was a team that sort of didn't commit to playing high up the pitch, but still wanted the added value of high regains. And so United actually had a lot of high regains last season, but they sort of the way they there were other aspects of the out of possession approach that meant the team was pretty difficult to break down in settled defense, and also was slower with the ball in a way that meant fewer fast transitions and sort of the counter press being compromised less. All of these things have been sort of exacerbated this season because there's been this active effort to play faster in possession that I think has led to a little bit more chance creation, but more than anything has led to a lot more chance concession to the opposition. And I think this is sort of the opposite of what you were looking for. Like, last season there were problems, and I think Aaron and I expected, and Aaron, correct me if I'm wrong here, if I'm putting words in your mouth, that there would be a step forward in a couple of specific areas. And instead of a step forward in those specific areas, you saw an attempted step in a different direction in other areas that sort of made the issues that already existed so much worse. And I think that was surprising to begin with, but I think what really has been the death knell has been the fact that there hasn't been a lot of adjustment in terms of approach. Not in terms of, there's been a lot of tactical tweaks that that have been instituted in different matches this season, but they still ultimately pursue the same tactical philosophy, which is just so flawed. So that may, I hope that answers your question. Aaron, do you have anything to add there?
I think you got most of it. I feel that if you go back and listen to the podcast last season, the two, or I'd say the one major caveat that we always presented with this United side was that no matter how good it got last year, they were not playing through high pressing setups. That's right. It really is that simple. They weren't making discernible attempts to play through sides that pressed high. And in rare occasions where they did try, it didn't really go well. And I think
it's an understatement.
Yeah, I think a key component of what would make or what would have made this United team elite would be the ability to play out of the back. And I think when you look at our predictions early in this season, I think one of the big caveats or one of the big worries that we had was that there would be a lot of teething issues this season trying to play out of the back, which would allow United to enter the final third more safely, lead to less transitional states with these sort of defensive crises that we've seen this season, and overall improve United's control of the game. And what we've seen instead is, I think it has actually gotten a lot worse. United play out of the back even less than they did last season against sides that do not press that high. Games have become even less within their control. And I also think there have been some changes to the way the midfield operates in the press. I think last season, what you would see very often was against a midfield two, Bruno and the second central midfielder, who would typically be Eriksen, sometimes it was Fred, would initiate man marking against the more advanced midfielders. And then someone like, typically, Casemiro would either have some sort of a man-to-man configuration with the opposition's most advanced midfielder, or be able to step into other zones because United would have a 3v2 in that situation where the opposition had their advanced midfielder and their striker, and United had Casemiro and two center backs able to deal with those players. But I think what's happening a lot this season instead is Bruno is actually joining pressing scenarios, and especially in 2024 this is happening. Then the back two midfielders jump onto deeper opposition midfielders in the press, and major,
when you're saying deep, when you're saying deeper, do you mean like what's deeper and what's advanced? Because you said advanced and deeper, and I think in a couple different contexts, and I think
let's for naivety's sake assume that United are operating with one deep midfielder and two advanced midfielders, and the opposition are operating with two deep midfielders and one advanced midfielder, such that there could, in theory, be man-marking arrangements on all of these players. I think a big component of why United have slowly declined defensively this season, and I do believe it has gotten worse as the season has gone on. I don't just think it was this bad in August.
I think it was this bad in October, though. Like, I think it's been this bad for a long time.
It was close, but United have been conceding north of 20 shots every single game since January. I don't think it was quite that bad.
I think it was.
It was getting there, but
yeah. Anyway, go ahead with your point. I have some stuff to add. So,
regardless, I think what you see is the insistence on. In particular, I think this is highlighted by Bruno, because last season United did press with a front three, but the insistence on them pressing with a front four, and A, not always picking sensible moments to press, and B, committing those four players but not backing them up with the rest of the press, has led to not only them being able to be played through more than last season, but when they are played through, for the opposition to have even more numerical superiority on the other side of that press, because Bruno is no longer marking midfielders with the same level of consistency as he was last season. He's more often marking opposition center backs or running at the goalkeeper. And I think that, and this has been extremely evident, especially against Liverpool today, is very evident, has left opposition midfielders to just be able to run with the ball in space at many moments throughout the match. And I think we talked about in another podcast how it's related to United also not being able to keep the ball very well. So what happens is they clear it and then they can't get up the pitch quickly enough to stop the opposition from playing out. Yep. By making the vertical lines compact. All of this is to say, I think the main components are they're being more aggressive in and out of possession, but not in a way that is controlled and is born of the correct ideas of how to improve upon last season in terms of control of the match, chances created and chances conceded.
Yeah, and I would sort of cook that idea down a little bit more and bring it sort of wrapping up this question from Richard. Essentially, the press attempts to have a numerical advantage against the opposition back line and a numerical advantage against the opposition's front line. And the compromise, the end result, is a massive numerical disadvantage in the middle of the park, in particular in wide areas. So wide, sort of the wings, like wide midfield, I'm going to call it. But I think you can picture that, right? And that's been exaggerated this season, but it existed last season. And so I would say for me, you mentioned the building out, absolutely a big thing. But for me, the press is the bigger thing. The thing that I think we could see was flawed last season, and it did not get better. It got worse because of fundamentally inaccurate assumptions about how the game is played.
Yeah. Going back to, I guess, where I think people might find this interesting is when looking at another coach, how do we avoid this happening again? How do we, either when Ten Hag was at Ajax or last season, be able to see this? I think a key problem, I don't know about problem, but a key difficulty here is that I think we were giving him the benefit of the doubt on things that we knew United were bad at, with the trust that with better resources, United would get good at those things. I don't think that is, of all managers in all history, an impossible assumption. Sometimes you have players who are bad at things and then you can't execute a certain way, and then you get the players who are better and you're able to execute a certain way. But I don't think it was fully correct for us to assume that that was always going to be the intent of this team. And I also think that I am in the future going to be less forgiving of projects where such big compromises are made from the very beginning, in that I really just think you need to set out to play a certain way from the start, fail, grow, and get to a point where you are confident in that way of playing, in order to actually challenge the teams at the top of the Premier League who are incredibly good at these things now and have been practicing them for a number of years. It can't just be, okay, we're not going to play out this season to get results, but the next season we're going to start playing out and we're also going to get results. It has to be a commitment to doing things a certain way and following through on that commitment. And I don't think it has to be black and white, but I think I lean further towards wanting to commit and not compromise from the start than I probably did when Ten Hag started. And I guess it is also a board structure thing. I don't think a new manager comes in and fixes this outright without the support of a better board, because you need to be able to make decisions like last season where you go, okay, De Gea, we can't play with De Gea. It's done. We're going to do whatever we can to get a goalkeeper in who's going to allow us to play the way we want to play, even if that goalkeeper isn't going to be the final form goalkeeper of this side. Whether that meant bringing in Dean Henderson, whether that meant bringing in another goalkeeper who could play the ball, but, you know, wasn't as good as De Gea in other areas. I think the same thing about the rest of this team. If you look at the teams that are successful in this league, they're not making compromises from an ideological perspective. They're not looking at Man City aren't going to have players like De Gea and Wan-Bissaka and McTominay. Same with Arsenal, same with Liverpool. Even if you look further down the table, you know, teams like Brighton, they're not going to have players like that either. If you look at teams that are going to have those kinds of players, maybe they play a different way and they commit to playing that sort of way. And then they build everything around trying to play that other kind of football that brings out the strengths of these players. That becomes a philosophical debate about what is the right way to play football. But I think either way, there needs to be a commitment to a specific style and then implementation to make that work as soon as possible and as well as possible right from the off.
I agree with that. I think the only caveat I would add is there is no set of players that makes the way United are playing right now stylistically viable. There's like, but I'm, you cannot play as vertically as United play. Period. You will never win a league title playing like this. It doesn't matter if you have the 11 best footballers on earth on the pitch. If you're trying to play this fast, they will have injury crises. Like, it is not a coincidence that this side keeps on having soft tissue injuries. Like, you cannot run. Like, you cannot full sprint this often. You cannot have high intensity sprints with this frequency every match when you're playing twice a week. You're going to concede goals, but you're also going to lose key players. Like, it is not, these injury crises are not a coincidence. There is no other side in football that plays like this. And yeah, I just want to emphasize that because I totally agree with what you're saying about like having a vision and going for it, and you need the right players to accomplish it. But also, you have to have the right vision.
I also think part of the problem, though, with respect to this season is getting stuck between multiple visions of how the team wants to play, especially out of possession. Like, I think there is this concept that, like you said, you can have this numerical superiority both up the pitch and back. And that's just not possible because you're giving up an entire part of the pitch to play that way. But it's like this, it's just a completely flawed conception of how football tactics exist in the modern era. You can't win every single battle. The point is to choose which battles are the most important to win and then win those. If you want to press high, you are at least to some extent conceding that in the event that your press is broken, you might concede high quality transitions. If you want to sit deep, you're going to concede that you're not going to be able to create chances that you would have been able to create if you pressed higher. You're not going to be able to prevent the opposition from gaining as much territory as you would be if you pressed higher. And now, obviously, that sounds like, you know, the first one isn't really a concession because United are not fully pressing high and they're conceding huge volume chances anyways in transition. But in theory, while it is possible to find the right trade-off such that you maximize the value you get in your press and also prevent the opposition from creating effective chances, I think Arsenal is a great example of that this season, you still have to get to a point where you're accepting a certain level of trade-off that comes with achieving a level of vertical and horizontal compactness that pretty much any successful team in the modern era, whether they're a bottom half team that consistently finishes above mid-table or a top half team that consistently challenges for the Premier League, teams that overperform their budgets, teams that win outright, they all accept a certain configuration of vertical and horizontal compactness that comes with certain trade-offs, with the knowledge that, or the belief that, the acceptance of those trade-offs will lead to better outcomes for them. And I think United have just not done that this season because they haven't committed to one particular way of playing that is acceptable in this sense.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. I think let's move on to a few other questions because we had quite a few good ones. So we've got one. We can keep on rolling right into similar content. We got a question from Vikram who asks if the problem seems to be the press is not compact enough because the fullbacks are not pushing up, is it a personnel problem for United? If yes, which fullbacks would give Erik the confidence to play a much more aggressive press? Yeah. Aaron, do you have thoughts on that? Sort of plays right into what we were just talking about.
Yeah, I think last season, I think the fullbacks not pushing up was quite a big problem. Again, visualizing what I just explained, United were giving away the ball less in early states, and they were a little bit more conservative in their press when the opposition were in deep buildup, particularly in how the midfield was. And that led to most of the gaps being out wide. So United were typically pressing an opposition back four. It was really problematic in games where United were pressing an opposition back five with three players. And then therefore the out ball was often to the fullbacks and the opposition fullbacks would have space to run into. And in that case, yes, I think the fullbacks not pushing was a problem. However, I think we both posited that it was a tactical choice rather than a personnel deficiency in United setup at the time. So it wasn't actually the fault of Dalot or Wan-Bissaka or Shaw or Malacia or anyone else who might have played fullback last season. I think this season is now different because you are creating holes in midfield with greater frequency. I think you have a lot of situational issues where now once that hole in midfield is created and exploited, you have a lot of really difficult defensive line decisions as to whether to push up towards the player who's carrying the ball and allow the opposition the chance to run in behind, or to follow the opposition in behind and let that player carry into your third. All of that is to say, I don't think that fullback is inherently the issue anymore. I think that the fullbacks could potentially help in the press if used differently, but I don't think that this is a matter of fix the fullbacks and everything is okay anymore. I will also say that doesn't necessarily mean that these fullbacks are flawless in the press. I don't think we've gotten to see the full extent of what players like Dalot, Wan-Bissaka, Shaw, Malacia would look like in an idealistic or in a more preferred pressing configuration. There's a chance that they might show signs of weaknesses. I just don't think that's been in the realm of what we've seen in Ten Hag's time at United. And so I wouldn't particularly be worried about signing a fullback specifically for what they can offer in the press. I do think United should sign fullbacks for different reasons, but that isn't really at the top of my mind at this exact moment.
Yeah, and I would take it a step further. Better players are always going to help, but better players will not solve the defensive issues. Like, this side is conceding 2 expected goals per match. You don't get a number that high without systemic issues. And more specifically, there are no defenders, whether they be fullbacks or center backs or defensive midfielders, who can defend the amount of space that United's players have to defend effectively. Like, you could roll out like your you know, France football team of the season back four, and if they have to defend behind this front six the way this front six makes out of possession decisions and is configured out of possession, they're going to concede a ton of goals. So no, I do not think this is a personnel issue. And that's not to say that the personnel is perfect. Like, there are huge personnel issues, but you don't get to a number like two goals a game without something else going on. And so, yeah, I'm always going to say, like, I'm pro getting new players in who are upgrades on who else is in the side, but I'm basically certain that it's not going to make a difference who you bring in if you keep on playing with this approach.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really, it really makes it difficult for us as people who try to talk about this team, because the tactics are flawed consistently and the same way without any discernible attempt to fix them. And they also make it very difficult to evaluate players as they work within the system, because the system needs to be thrown out. And so we can't go, oh yeah, the fullbacks are showing deficiencies in this system that will be long-term problems for us, because ideally long-term, this will not be the system. I don't think that this is necessarily an incorrect train of thought from Vikram that, you know,
no,
fullbacks are causing issues. Could it be a personnel issue? It's just a matter of, like, I think we need to see a new configuration of the side before we can really decide. With that, I think we can move on to the next question. With it seeming like Ten Hag is staying on for next season, do you see any merit in doing this? Do you see any merit in doing the following? Saving money, waiting for a proper structure to appoint a new manager and provide a solid framework, get the squad in a better state for someone coming in, etc. And that comes from Mo. I can take this one first. It does seem, based on rumors, that it's a possibility that Ten Hag will stay another season. I've also seen this said about many other people at United who did not end up staying. Most recent example being someone like De Gea, who was rumored to be signing on, and then just never, it was never confirmed until very late on, and then eventually he was just never offered a contract by the looks of it, or never offered a contract that suited what he wanted. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that Ten Hag is staying. I think, by the sounds of it, Ineos are really changing how United are going to operate. And I think that could lead to discontent on both sides, whether they still want Ten Hag to be in charge, whether Ten Hag still wants to be in charge of that team. As for whether it's worth letting him stay and save money, to me, it just sounds like letting time pass. Like, I think if you want to set a template for the future, you have to set that template and work towards it. And it doesn't really matter how long you can come up with all kinds of reasons to delay it. But if you want to reach that state of being a highly competitive team, you need to start laying the foundations now. I said this to Case earlier in the week. I'll say it on here as well. If Ten Hag stays, either there's some level of lack of understanding of where this season is going wrong internally, which would be very worrying, or there's something that we don't know externally, because it's not just reached the point where the performances are underwhelming. This is so ridiculously bad and absurd every single week that there's no way that the people running the club don't see this. The Glazers would have seen it. Every person in the history of Manchester United would be able to tell that this is not how the team should look and play on a weekly basis. And so for key decision makers who in theory are thinking about this more often than us to come in and say, we think he should stay, there has to be some kind of logical disconnect that we're missing. Like, I do not accept any other explanation for it.
I agree. I think this is also a good opportunity for me to say something I've been meaning to say for a while. A lot of people now invoke Mikel Arteta as like an example of an instance where a manager was doing very, very poorly and then turned it around. And now obviously Arsenal are fantastic. I just want to compare where Arteta's Arsenal were at when they sort of bottomed out versus where we are at now. I think most people would tell you that Arteta's Arsenal bottomed out around Christmas of 2020. So let's say January 1st, 2021, they sat 13th in the table. At that point, they had played 16 matches in the league. They'd created 18.75 expected goals in those 16 matches and allowed 19.62 expected goals against in those 16 matches, which works out to a negative 0.05 expected goal difference per 90. So basically, that's around league average. That would generally put you around like 9th or 10th in a typical season, and they sat 13th, as I just mentioned. They were allowing 1.22 expected goals per 90, which is actually okay. It's not a big deal. Their problem was really more the attack. As of today, Man United sit in 6th place, so that's significantly better than 13th. They've played 31 matches, creating 48.8 expected goals and allowing 61.2 expected goals for an expected goal difference of minus 0.39. They're allowing 1.97 expected goals per 90. That's good for the 18th best defense in the league. Just for context, that negative 0.39 expected goal difference, when Fulham went down in 2021, they had an XG difference of negative 0.42. So just in the scheme of things, you can literally get relegated playing the way United are playing right now. Like, that is the level of shot quality in terms of opposition versus like for versus against the team is conceding on the pitch this season. Like, it's not hyperbole to say that these performances are relegation quality. And I really do think, not even think, you can see it in the numbers. The only thing separating United from being in the bottom half is Andre Onana has had a fantastic shot-stopping season. Like, I don't think people clock how many shots he's faced and how much shot quality he's saved. And number two is the team has just been running hot in front of goal. Well, actually, no, it's not. The last few weeks, the team has been running hot in front of goal. Yeah, this team is, like, in terms of performances, awful. It's way worse than it ever got at Arsenal. And the only thing that's papering that over is where they're sitting in the table.
Yeah.
This is not the same thing. And to take it a step further, the fact that the defense is as bad as it is says something entirely different from what Arsenal's problem was, which is that their attack was really poor. They were barely managing over a goal a game. You can see where Arsenal wound up. And even then, a lot of people I know who follow Arsenal very closely felt that the tactical foundations of a much better side were there because their defense was actually pretty effective and they had a lot of control over matches. United have no foundations for control over matches. And like that is why the defense is so poor. And that's why this is so much worse, because there isn't, the next step is not, you know, just getting the attack working. It's not just, you know, pumping out a few extra goals. It's completely reforming how you approach the game out of possession. Like, these are not equivalent undertakings. Like, we are not in the same place Arsenal were when they turned things around. So, like, it's a bad analogy. It is not, we are not in parallel situations.
This is incredibly noisy data we're working with. So I'm gonna add a couple things here. First of all, that Arsenal side, it's used a lot as an example of how when a team is pretty bad at first, you should stick with it because it might get better. I think that Arsenal side is probably the worst side ever to get this good. Like, you look at teams historically that have become as good as Arsenal are now in the Premier League, there's probably what, in the last 10 years, maybe like 5 or 6 teams in that, even debatably in that category.
Yeah,
you got Pep City, Klopp's Liverpool, maybe Poch's Spurs, maybe like one or two of the Chelsea sides.
Maybe. Yeah.
None of them were ever this bad, ever, as Arteta's Arsenal were. When Mourinho fell out at Chelsea and they appointed And they appointed Hiddink for the rest of the season. What year was that? 2015-16.
Yep.
Yeah. They were 7th in the table for non-penalty expected goal difference at the end of the season with +9 overall, which shakes out at least a quarter of a goal per game, better than Arteta's Arsenal were in the numbers you just stated.
Yep.
And that was despite having one of the biggest managerial fallouts in the history of a club that is known for managerial fallouts.
And an aging squad.
And that was a bad team, and they were better than Arteta's Arsenal. Like, that Arsenal team was very bad. And obviously they have been rewarded for their decision to keep Arteta. But I don't think that it's a good example, because even though Arteta has turned it around, I don't think they should have been that bad. Secondly, this is more just like an interesting point as opposed to like changing anything you said, but a lot of United's differential actually does come from set pieces, which this is sort of like a separate point that I'm going to make. United are in the double digits of expected goal difference worse than Arsenal and Manchester City on set pieces. And I think if there's anything that I believe should just almost immediately become a lot better under a well-managed side, I think it would be the set piece performance. I don't think this has to do with the height of the players. I think this is actually just an easy way to get 10 goals back into this team, is to invest something into getting the set pieces to work. And you're seeing Chelsea do this. Chelsea just signed Brentford's set piece coach in an attempt to get better at set pieces. This, every single team in the league is going to be trying to emulate what Arsenal and City have done. I think that's a massive lever in how Arsenal have gotten better since they were struggling to attack under Arteta, is by becoming the league's best or second best team at set pieces, or at least second best big team at set pieces. These teams are not comparable. Like, and even if they were, I will maintain that if United were as good as Arteta's Arsenal in 2021, if the tactical foundations are there, I wouldn't necessarily say sack Ten Hag, but I would still be deeply concerned that the team would ever get as good as Arsenal have been today, because you just don't see that happen in the broad scheme of things. They are the one team that has managed to do it ever.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to say ever, because I don't know the history.
Or at least in my lifetime.
Yeah. In my lifetime.
In the lifetime of myself, as well as expected goal difference, yeah. I'm pretty sure they're the only team.
Maybe Leicester City
in 2015. Like, maybe Leicester City the season before were relegation quality, and then the season after were top 6 or 7. But they weren't, that Leicester team was not as good as Arsenal is now.
Yeah, so it's a huge outlier in terms of, yeah.
And I certainly wouldn't be comparing United to the title winning Leicester City side. So
no. Yeah. Agree with basically everything you said. I think it, even if this United team were comparable to that Arsenal team, which they're not, they're way worse, it wouldn't be grounds to keep him. There's no way I can talk myself into thinking it's a good idea for him to stay past this summer. It really doesn't matter. Like, I've also heard a lot of people say, well, who do you replace him with? It really doesn't matter who you replace him with. Not because whoever you replace him with is just going to fix everything, but because we know he's not going to fix everything. So, like, as soon as you have confidence that like one person is not the solution or part of the solution, then you should try something else, even if you're not sure that something else is part of the solution. Like, you don't have to have conviction that the next thing is the solution to move on from something you're sure is not.
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm going to say one more thing about that Arsenal team, by the way. Their squad was so much worse than this current United team. They were seriously lacking in top talent at that stage. And one of the other things, so I talked about how set pieces catalyzed their attacking form. Another thing that catalyzed their attacking form was literally having players who could operate in the half spaces. So anybody who watched that Arsenal side when they were struggling would note that they really just didn't have players who could pick up the ball in advanced central areas, turn on the ball, and be able to create chances from central zones, which is pretty much a surefire way to just kill any attacking play because they couldn't keep the ball in advanced areas. They were basically just recycling the ball around, up the wings, back around, and hoping that there would be an opportunity to play a ball into a striker. And a big catalyst for them improving was getting in players like Emile Smith Rowe at the time, and then Martin Odegaard, who were able to turn their attacking play into something more cohesive. United already have players who are capable of playing. I'm not saying this squad's perfect, by the way. I think this season has shown that there are a lot of there are a lot of players who should not be at United. There are a lot of players who are maybe good enough to be at a different version of United, but they don't fit in with the current squad. But it is still a much more talented team than that Arsenal side. We've seen multiple United players have really good individual seasons in spite of the awful, awful team-wide form. And I think you will find that there are at least half a dozen players who, in better sides, and hopefully in better future United sides, will be very, very good players for very, very good teams. And I don't think Arsenal had some players in by then, but it certainly wasn't like three quarters of their team that was filled with, you know, top five team level Premier League players.
Yeah, I agree. And I think United have a bottom three defense by expected goals conceded right now. Like literally relegate, like worse than relegation quality, because you don't have to have a bottom three defense to be relegation quality. There's no way any of, like, if you look at the shit, like the players who have played in defense and in midfield for this United team, they are not relegation quality players. Like, you're going to have somebody goofy, I'm sure, who's going to tell you, oh, Maguire's been relegated multiple times in his career. Sure, he also starts for England and consistently plays well for England and isn't out of, like, is not out of place in a Premier League side. Like, this is not a relegation quality footballer. Varane, even though I think he's flawed, is not a relegation quality footballer. Casemiro, who I think has been horrid this season, I still don't think is a relegation quality footballer. Like, this team should not be this bad defensively. There's no excuse for it.
Just the Arsenal team. So on Boxing Day in 2021, Arsenal beat Chelsea 3-1 with Smith Rowe in the team. I don't know if you remember that game. It was their first win since October at the time. So they had gone 2 months winless. And the team that started that game included Bernd Leno, Hector Bellerin, Rob Holding, Pablo Mari, Kieran Tierney, Mohamed Elneny, Emile Smith Rowe, and Lacazette. It also had Saka, Martinelli, Xhaka as the only three players who
went on to play regularly. Was that Boxing Day 2020 or Boxing Day 20?
No, I'm wrong. That's 2020. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, the 2020-2021 season, rather. Yeah, the team had 8 out of 11 players who stopped playing regularly for Arsenal by last season, and a further 9th who stopped playing regularly for Arsenal this season. This was not the team that ended up being Arteta's top 4 consistent, title-challenging, regularly side. Whereas I would like to think if United are to be a consistent top 4 team in the future, Garnacho, Hoyland, Mainu, if he's still young enough, Bruno, if he's still young enough, Rashford, if he's still young enough, Luke Shaw, Lisandro Martinez, Diogo Dalo, Andre Onana, are all very likely to be a part of that side. And there are a couple of others who I think are close to being good enough or good enough to contribute regularly.
I mean, so, I think if you get the right manager in, you can finish top 4 with this squad again. Like
yeah. But I don't think this Arsenal squad could have finished top 4.
No, I don't think so either. Like, yeah.
It's just a ridiculous comparison. Like, it holds no weight at all. This United team, this squad is better than the team that bottomed out under Solskjaer and Rangnick in 2021-2022.
And it's playing worse. Yeah, I agree. And I think you can see it in the quality of the goals that the team scores. Like, there have been so many moments of immense quality from this United team this season.
The goals today, by the way.
Insane. Ridiculous. Insane. And they were insane against Liverpool last time, and they were insane against Chelsea midweek. And, like, you know, maybe to a certain extent it's a little unfair to completely remove the manager from that equation. But for the most part, it is just, like,
technical. He has a responsibility insofar as he put the players on the pitch. Like, he put the players on the pitch. He chose to promote Garnacho.
I also
he chose to promote Mainoo.
But I also think the style of play leads to, like, these stretch game states that mean you can, like, it provides space for attacking talent to shine, kind of. Like, not in the aggregate, but in individual moments.
Forces opposition mistakes, maybe, but not as many as United make, so.
Yeah. Not important to the point, which is just that we've seen this season a lot of these players do wonderful things. and a lot of them have also done horrible things, like been really bad on the pitch. But most of them are good footballers. And I will, you're not going to be able to convince me otherwise. I think we leave it there. That is all I have to say on this issue.
All right, let's move to another question then. All right, let's talk about some brighter subjects, such as the players. Firstly, Kaby Mainoo. Okay, this question comes from Owen. There's been a lot of discourse around Mainoo's current level on analytics Twitter lately. However, if you compare his progressive numbers with some of the elite midfielders in the league and adjust them for passes received to account for the fact United often bypass their midfield, giving him less opportunities on the ball, these numbers become mostly comparable to some of the best midfielders in the league. Given this, do you disagree with much of the discourse around Mainoo in the analytics community currently, that he is a promising talent but currently isn't all that great? I'll go first on this one. Okay. Or you can go first on this one.
I'll go quickly. I don't know that I'm not a huge fan of doing touch adjustments for players, because generally speaking, the best players get on the ball a lot. And that's because their teammates seek them out and for a variety of other reasons. But I will say this. Some of you probably saw my mini rant about this on Twitter like a week or two ago. Almost all of the publicly available metrics that we have for assessing midfielder quality are either really narrow in terms of their like appropriate use or downright like bad. And sometimes like if you use them in the very narrow context within which they are informative, they can be exactly that, informative. But for the most part, my conviction about Mainoo isn't really affected by the numbers for a few reasons. A, players as young as him who are clearly talented often do not have good metrics. And there are so many examples of this, but 18-year-olds, like even the best 18-year-olds usually have really bad numbers. The only like exception to this is like Kylian Mbappe. Even if you go back like Messi, when he was 18, his numbers are not impressive. Like the advanced metrics that you would have looked at. But he was clearly incredibly talented and affecting games. There's a lot of potential explanations for this. One of them is what you've sort of posited, that they don't get on the ball as much, whether that's for a confidence reason or their teammates not seeking them out, difficult to say. But it like ultimately where I land on this is the following. Mainoo is better than the numbers suggest. He's also 18, so he probably isn't as good as his best moments. His overall like effect on games is probably less than his potential to affect games in like, you know, flashes like we saw today. But that doesn't mean he's like a below average current Premier League footballer. I think that's anybody who's suggesting that is being a bit ludicrous, I think. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah, I'll answer it a little differently, more focused on the last thing you said, which is, is he currently an above average or good contributor at Premier League level? And I do think that you're right in terms of touch adjustments and the fact that, you know, if he was one of the best players in the Premier League right now, he would be getting the ball more than he does. I do agree with that. I think that touch adjusted passing and dribbling metrics have a place, the same way that per 90 passing and dribbling metrics have a place. I think by using both of them, you can garner some information about a player. I also think they are flawed because they don't look at where the player is progressing the ball. They don't look at different situational contexts. They're over aggregated and under contextualized. And as a whole, I think
we have no way of effectively quantifying pressure, like pressure on the ball. How much, like, how many players are around a player when they receive the ball, and how difficult the situation, like how difficult the circumstances within which they receive the ball are. And I think that's key in particular for Mainu. Sort of go ahead, but
stuff. Yeah. So I'll give you a couple of indicators in the data that say that Mainu is actually a very highly effective player. Number one is, despite his lack of touches, he is a high volume dribbler in the Premier League at 18 for central midfield. And I think that is one of the, it's still very limited, but one of the best ways of reading that he is facing pressure situations, in that he isn't just carrying the ball forward. He's actually dribbling past players and doing it successfully. The second is that, much like dribbling, he is also carrying to that level. So that means he's, it, like, I think you have a good idea at this point, both in the stats, in the public stats, and to our eyes, that he is good at reading opportunities to carry the ball into space. He is good at dribbling past other players. He is good at keeping the ball under pressure. I think what determines the difference between Mainu's impact right now, regardless of what's in the stats and what the top midfielders in the Premier League are doing, is the regularity, the frequency with which he's doing it. But I don't think that just because a player isn't progressing the ball in high volume, that means that the extremely high value actions that he offers are balanced as a below average or average Premier League player. Like, I think if you gave Kobbie Mainoo at any age to a number of Premier League teams, he would be a regular in most of those teams, because the things that he does do are things that most players in the Premier League cannot do. And that deserves warranting for. Now, I think whether Mainoo becomes an elite player will come down to whether he can turn that into consistent ball progression and then probably either high-level attacking impact, which you've seen with like things like the goal today. I think he could be very good in the final third. Or high-end defensive impact, which you've also seen flashes of, but I think he'd have to develop a fair amount physically in order to get to that point. But yeah, I think it's really decontextualized to say that this is a player who either A, is not currently contributing at a high level, or B, is going to need some level of like great unnatural development in order to become a high-end Premier League player. I think he's already well on his way, and playing in a better team with a little bit more physical and senior level game maturity, this is a player who already has all the technical tools to be a really good player.
One thing that has come up is that his peak sprint speed that he registers is often the lowest of any player on the pitch. Few things. Peak sprint speed is not a very good statistic for a variety of reasons. Different players sprint in different contexts. It's difficult to assess when a player is in a full sprint. Some players sprint more often, which means you're going to have, like, anytime you, if you, you know, take any variable that has like an average and a normal distribution, and
you'll hit then, the tails more often if you replicate a number of times.
Exactly. If you replicate the experiment 1,000 times versus like 1,000,000 times, you're more likely to hit the tails, the really low probability instances, which are, you know, in this instance, really high and really low sprint speeds. So if you sprint less, your high-end sprint speed that registers is going to be lower. Not necessarily because you are slower, but because you're running less and there's fewer instances, if that makes sense. It's just, like a lot of metrics, just really noisy and flawed. I don't think Mainoo is particularly fast. I'm not worried about it, though. I'm not that worried about it. I think we play very end-to-end, which means he probably needs to be careful with his energy levels. I saw a lot of people complaining about him and Casemiro jogging during the Chelsea match midweek. I try not to get too caught up in effort discourse. I think both of them are trying. I'm not going to lie to you. I think the way we play is really taxing. And that's not to say that like their effort levels are always exactly where they should be, but I think on balance, Mainoo has been very good defensively given what's been asked of him. And I don't think he's necessarily going to be a high impact physicality player, but I think it's fine. If I am given reason to worry about it, I will, but I'm not worried about it right now.
Yeah, I think that's good on Mainoo. Let's talk about Mount, who has come back into the team with, I'd say, some relatively impressive cameos in the last few matches. Jack Maloney asks, simply put, where does Mount fit in?
Fourth midfielder, plays, 25, 90s in the league through sub appearances and starts. You can use him as an 8, you can use him as a 10. If he's healthy, I think this is just I don't think this is like a top priority thing. I think he's kind of tough to fit into the side. I will admit that, but he's also pretty versatile and just generally good, like way better than a lot of other footballers we use often. So, I think that's kind of my take.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think the ultimate, another thing I'd say about this is I don't think people realize how much the fourth best player in a position where you select 3 or the third best player in a position where you select 2 actually plays in a Premier League season for these top teams. Like, try and name Man City's best 11 and then look at the 3 best players who are not in their starting 11. Do the same with Arsenal. Do the same with Liverpool. The players who are in that group are A, playing a ton of minutes, and B, very, very good players. I don't think it has to be as simple as, does this player fit into a fixed starting 11 for Manchester United to be a valuable signing? I think it has to be, given the current options that are available, does this player make us better? And I think Mount does, very, very obviously.
Yeah, totally agree. Okay, let's move on. Martinez, real quick.
Yeah, so Xavi asks, a lot has been made of Martinez and his supposed weaknesses. Do you think he would suit a high line? Should we move him to left back? Personally, I think the criticism is overblown, but we might need to upgrade considering his injury issues. Yeah, I think I agree with Xavi here, pretty much. I mean, I don't think that, I think the criticism is unfounded. I don't think it's impossible that it ends up being true. I just think that we haven't seen Martinez play this season. Last season, United did play a slightly deeper defensive line in phases. I think largely the evidence we have is that Lissandro is a good defender in a high line and an excellent player in possession. Like, we're talking top 2 or 3 in the world in his position in possession. And so I think that kind of player has a very good future in a United team that looks to play through pressure and on the front foot. That's not to deny his weaknesses and, deny the people who are concerned about this. I don't think that anything has happened that should have changed the perspectives on Martinez so much from last season when he was probably relative to position United's best player. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I look at it this way. I've seen him play in a high line in Champions League matches, like one of the most aggressive high lines I've ever seen, and do so effectively against like some of the best players in the world. So I'm not worried about him in a high line. I don't think anything that's happened this season is reason to like worry about him having key weaknesses. He hasn't played very much. When he has, he's been asked to do things that like no one can do effectively. There aren't footballers who could play in this setup as center back and not concede goals. Yeah, that's number 2. Number 3, I am now worried about the injuries. Now we've had 3 major ones in a season. I don't think it necessarily means he is like that an attribute of his is that he is injury prone himself yet, but I do think when you fatigue the body this much over the course of a season and have this many injuries, it generally means you probably need a long recovery period and you might never be the same. So yeah, I do think we need to start talking, like, and also back to your point about like second choice players. It's pretty key that you just have more than two, like more than two good center backs. And so I think you go get another guy who can play left center back.
Yeah, I think as a whole, people are quite low on United center backs relative to me. I actually don't think United's three best center backs, in my view, Martinez, Maguire, and Varane, are actually that much of a problem relative to some of the other issues in the team. I do think it becomes likely that Varane leaves, and you might also see Lindelof leave, which could make room for one to two more signings in this position. But a lot of people have it as like their number one priority for the summer, and not only do I not think it's United's number one area in terms of squad strengthening, I also don't think it's where the problems on the pitch are actually occurring. We can move on to one more question here, which was somewhat related from Name Change FC. Thoughts on Kambwala's performance today? Is it possible for him to be first choice right center back next to Martinez next season, or is it too early to tell?
Short answer is it's too early to tell. Longer answer is I do not think he will be the first choice right center back next season. I don't think that would be prudent to plan on, but I think he has a chance to be a part of the squad. I need to see a lot more. Yeah.
I'd like to see him continue playing instead of someone like, you know, Evans, who obviously isn't going to be part of the future of the team. I think, why not, right? I think you run the real possibility that United are going to replace a lot of center back minutes this summer in the form of players like Lindelof and Evans. I don't think United should be spending $50 million on a fourth choice center back. I don't think it's actually that hard to find a center back who's better than Lindelof and Evans. The combination of those things means that there is a space here for a talented youth player to come in into the first team side without too much difficulty. I don't even think he needs to be a Mainoo or Garnacho level prospect. I think he just has to be pretty good and able to step in. And I think you'll find that in general, center backs in the Premier League who are average to above average in good setups are fine. They will fare fine. And so, yeah, I think the conclusion here is let's play him a little bit more and see what's up. But I think the defensive stuff was good today. He had some flashes of quality on the ball. I think the signs are pretty good for him.
Yeah, I agree. All right, that was rapid fire on a couple of players. I think let's wrap it up, right? Let's call
yeah, it. Yeah, I think we'll wrap it up here. In spite of United's wild form, some interesting things to talk about. I hope that the next few weeks come with some changes that give us some more optimism. But I say that at the end of every episode. So as long as it is the way it is, we are here for the ride. And we appreciate you guys for listening. Thank you so much. And we'll hopefully see you next week. Hope you enjoyed this week's Devils in the Details. You can follow us at Devils ITD Pod on Twitter or on a variety of streaming platforms. Our awesome theme music was made by Jacob Connor. You can find at Jacob J. Connor on Twitter. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.